Thank you for joining us today at the Thai Podcast. Welcome to the show.
And there's something about club culture that's just, you know, different all over the world. It's not just US, UK, it's the whole lot. And I think that's the real sweet spot, is the fact that you go to these places and you're like, God, all the customs are out the window now. Whereas I know how to go to most clubs in the UK and just be like, yeah, kind of understand this. It's all sort of, you know, you almost know where the toilets are when you walk through the clubhouse, because you just know how everything's geared up for you. In the US, you're like, okay, I've got no idea what I'm supposed to do now. Do I go to the range? What do I do? Do I, you know, do I tip this person? Like, you're just terrified everywhere you go.
Okay, so what did you think of it? I'm curious to hear from your perspective.
Loved it.
Good, yes. I love the Dormer Bermuda. Yeah.
See, I remember playing the PTS Wound as a kid, because it was like, it was so soft. It was like, the ladies' ball, wasn't it, really? That was kind of what I was brought up on.
You know what I was brought up on? You know, Walker and I are both firmly within the Tiger era. Like, I guess we were born in 97, 98. So, you know, when I'm 7 or 8 years old, that's like 2004, 2005, like prime time. And the Nike Mojo, like, that's what got me fired up to go play golf. And it was like, I'm trying to think of how to describe it. It was almost like slightly metallic, the look of it. Probably just a horrendous golf ball. But, you know, I was terrible back then. I had no idea what a good golf ball was. But that's what got me fired up, playing a Nike Mojo.
That brought me back. I forgot about those. I was just thinking the Pro V1 with the really weak line. Like, they made it more solid over time, but I just remember thinking, why is it so faded? If we're gonna have a line, let's have a line.
You remember the dimple count?
392. Is that
392, exactly. Yeah.
So that's the number of dimples on the ball.
That's my understanding. I could be wrong about that one, but I'm pretty sure that's what that was, is the dimple count. But yeah, that's a cool piece of memorandum. I love the shed, guys. It's it's a lot better than you know, Andy Johnson shed over here. I'll sling Andy a little anti shout out there. but yeah, that's good work. We need to get the Thai shed going here in not too long.
Well, it looks like about working from is coming a shed. Along. There's something about working from a shed which is quite. It's just, it's away from the house. You can just separate yourself from any family. And it's a shed. You can do what you like to it. At the end of the day, you can knock it down and start again. It's, can't really go wrong with it.
I love the wood.
Guys, give us a quick update on, we didn't really talk about this a whole lot last time we had gotten together to record anything. Where are you guys at on the, you know, podcasting versus professional side of things, regular jobs, podcasting jobs, cookie jar? Would be curious to hear where you guys are on that arc of things.
Fire away, Sam.
No, you go. You're good at this one, Tom. Tom's got a great line he likes to throw in.
Oh, what is it?
Full-time hours, part-time wage, whatever.
Well, no, I haven't used that in 2 years, because it's now full-time hours. Full-time job, but to cut a long story short, you know, we've been on 4 years now. The podcast has been on 4 years. The videoing is probably three and a bit. About 18 months ago, I went full-time. Sam is now full-time. We have a full-time employee. We're about to take on a second full-time employee, and that covers a wide gamut of things, which are our public-facing content, the private-facing content, events, merchandise, lots of things like that. So it's grown arms and legs, I think, from when it started. But we're now in a position where we kind of just throw a resource at it, and some people listen, some people don't, and we're just trying to corner a very small part of the market over here in the UK, really.
Yeah. Bring me back great to fun, 2020, because this was a COVID project. I know we've gone over this before, but it's a lot of growth in three short years.
Yeah, it was like a couple of weeks before COVID, so we started it in Jan 2020, which, it's not the time to just sort of take a wandering sort of effort into podcasting, because it's really not the time of year. And then a few weeks later, COVID just hit. So we were, you know, everything was kind of all up in the air. It was that really weird thing when it first kicked off in Jan 2020. We didn't really know what was going to happen in the world, did we? But actually, it was the perfect thing, because when something's really fresh, you can kind of really obsess over it. So, you know, we were just constantly getting people on the podcast who, you know, they're just sat at home all day. You know, people really looking to fill their days, because all the golf was stopped. You know, I remember doing things with people like, there's a popular broadcaster like Iona Stephen. You know, it's like she's got time on her hands all of a sudden to speak to a bunch of Muppets who are curious to hear her story. So it's been good fun. Everything just leads to the next thing, doesn't it? So I'm sure you guys find out. I mean, it's a great game. There's so much breadth to it. And it's weird. You kind of hit sort of spurts of creativity where you've got loads of good ideas, and all of a sudden the sort of chamber's full of loads of great content. And then you have times where it feels like there's a bit of a drought, and, you know, you just kind of get used to the feast and famine of it all, really. How about you guys?
Henry, go for it.
Okay, I'll start. We are both, you know, kind of halfway full-time podcasting and very full-time regular working. So just burning a lot of hours at it, which is fun. You know, we're both still in our mid-20s with plenty of energy to put towards it. But, you know, plenty of early mornings and plenty of late nights on both ends of it.
Do you remember your mid-20s, Sam?
Yeah, no, not
I've got
really.
No idea what my mid-20s
Do you know,
look
I
like.
Wasted them. I totally wasted them. You know, like you need a side hustle like something like this.
So, yeah. Curious, this is like non-golf related. When you say wasted them, are we talking wasted them with the bottle or without the bottle? Because I get caught in between as well. Like, I spend a lot of Friday and Saturday nights in because I'm working on this stuff. And sometimes I'm like, am I doing this right? Am I doing this backwards? So curious to hear your take there.
I don't know. I don't know. I'm always feel like I procrastinate. So I don't know. I didn't develop a business or a podcast in my 20s. So I, you know, doing that now and sitting here, hell yeah, I wish I'd have started sooner and got on with it. So I think the temptation being, you know, coming out of university or college, as you guys would say, is that you've got to get straight into that sort of corporate ladder. But I think it's really easy to get sucked down that vortex, give away sort of 10, 15 years of your best life, and then get to the other end and think, ah, Christ, I could have actually diverted that energy in other ways, or kind of spread the load a little bit. So
it's cool. Been a little bit easier from my end too, because I've kind of always been in golf, and they kind of merge together in a way. I think, Henry, you may echo this as well. We're like, I think we're both very willing, if you consider this wasted time, both like very willing to spend it doing this. And I don't know, at times it feels so right. It is interesting trying to grow something, because there's like a practical nature to it. Like, of course you want to grow, but we are both just like so interested in this stuff, like you two are. Mm. And figuring out at times when to like, it's kind of just like playing golf, choosing your spots. Like, when do you think of it as a business, and when do you really like move forward on an idea, and when do you chill out and just say, hey, we're having a good time learning about this and we have no real initiative here. Balancing the two is a weird dance that we've kind of had to do. I wonder if you guys have had the same thing at times.
I think the strange thing about it is if you really wanted to do whatever we wanted to do all the time, it would be so niche that no one would listen to it.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to sometimes think, you know, growth mindset, do something that's a little bit broader. How are we going to access a few more listeners and then maybe force them foie gras style into thinking how you think, and, you know, oh, let's now just delve back into sort of architecture. So, yeah, there is difficulty in doing what you want to do and then, you know, appeasing the masses really and trying to grow it for sure.
So tell me,
take interest in anything, don't they? Like, you literally go and sit on Instagram Reels for 2 minutes and you look at the weird sort of stuff that pops up. The reality is there's tastes for everything. So if you just stick to what actually interests you most of the time, like, you're probably going to do a pretty good job. And we've never been done a great job. Like, we make no bones about it on our podcast. We don't watch enough professional golf. Anti-social hours, it's staying up till midnight on a Sunday to watch the conclusion. It's a huge investment of time, and frankly I think there's others that do it better than us, so yeah, we kind of just try and I guess kind of swim in your own lane, really.
So what's the foie gras, if you will? Like, what what do y'all enjoy doing the most that fairly efficient on the time front that you just love doing more than any other part, cookie jar wise? Is it video I'd stuff? Say, is it podcasting? Something else?
Well, I think the hiring of the new guy that we're bringing along shortly is going to sort of open up video a bit more to us. I think at the moment we've been caught up doing some of the private work that just requires a bit more of our attention. But essentially, I mean, whether it's podcasting or video, the real kind of foie gras of it is history and architecture and travel. I think travel's the big one that really resonates with a lot of people. And it's so interesting when you do podcasts about travel and architecture and history, and they all land pretty well, but invariably it's the cheap places or the places that no one's heard of. And everyone's heard of, you know, Muirfield or Royal Liverpool. Everyone's heard of them. And if you do piece on it, it's like, yeah, it'll land well. Everyone's heard about it, but it's not really a scoop. And if you can, Sam's really good, you know, credit where credit's due. Sam's really good at digging out stupid places that you wouldn't really go. And we've just come back from Ireland a few days ago. And yeah, we played some blockbusters while we're out there. We're not being shy about it. We managed to play Royal County Down and Port Marnock, but then we sort of coupled that up with a place called Kirkaston, which is like £30 to play, which I'd never heard of. It's a links course kind of just south of Belfast, and another place called Corbalis, which is near Dublin, which again is roughly in the sort of €30 figure, which again, that's just blockbuster. Corbalis. I know we've done a piece on Corbalis, but blockbuster place, 15 minutes from Dublin Airport. All dunes. It's just marram dunes, firm ground, fast greens. What's not to like? Short as well. Very short course.
It's a delight, isn't it? And we're going to talk a bit about, you know, obviously we had an unbelievable trip to the US at the start of the year. Like, that is one big way to kick off January. It's a bloody expensive start to the new year as well for us.
Not just on the travel, on the golf side too, if you're paying for that.
Wow.
Caddies,
my goodness. Oh,
they just not get you. Like, that's the thing.
It doesn't exist here. Well, it does. But, you know, it's not enforced on you, really. And it's something that you're just not used to. You're not really budgeting for. And then when you walk away, spend $1,000 on caddies in 5 days, it's like, whoa. You know, that really stings. So it's a good job. I mean, if cookie jar goes under, I know exactly what I'm doing. I wouldn't be
Find
a good
course,
caddy, but I'd be a
couple
caddy,
loops
yeah.
A day. You'd be doing great.
Oh. Double bagging's like we made so many errors in America, honestly. We're like the archetypal idiots. You know, it's like, I'll tell a short story. Do you mind if I just delve into a short story about where we
Please.
Were?
Please.
We were, I'm sure we'll touch on this, but in our America trip, we visited a hoopy, and Caddy Master Hoopy, the coolest dude on the planet. So cool. Big shades, always grinning. Mega cool. And I said, look, what's the caddy fee? And he tells me the caddy fee. I said, right, like, I can't deal with this because I'm British. So can you just tell me exactly the amount I need to pay? Like, I don't care what it is, really. Just tell me what it is, because I can't be doing with ambiguity. And he says, okay, it's $200. He's like, okay, fine, I'll pay $200 at the end. And then we're playing foursomes, so the caddy picks up my bag and Sam's bag. So we get to the end. It's like, okay, well, that's quite nice. It's $200. Hand it over. And we're like, just checking. That's right, isn't it? And he's like, yeah, that's a man, dude. We're like, okay. Pull out another $200. It's just, I mean,
I think it's the naivety.
It's just we're not used to it. Didn't know, weren't used to it, didn't budget for it, and it stung. Good experience, but
this is the real beauty of golf, though, isn't it? Because, you know, if we played tennis and then I went over to the US to play tennis, I suspect everything around that game would feel pretty familiar. You know, I'd put the bag down, have my drinks, you know, we'd warm up, we'd play a few sets, we'd maybe grab a beer afterwards or something. And there's something about club culture that's just, you know, different all over the world. It's not just US, UK, it's the whole lot. And I think that's the real sweet spot, is the fact that you go to these places and you're like, God, all the customs are out the window now. Whereas I know how to go to most clubs in the UK and just be like, yeah, kind of understand this. It's all sort of, you know, you almost know where the toilets are when you walk through the clubhouse, because you just know how everything's geared up for you. In the US, you're like, okay, I've got no idea what I'm supposed to do now. Do I go to the range? What do I do? Do I, you know, do I tip this person? Like, you're just terrified everywhere you go. And because and it's
invariably,
like,
invariably yeah. you end up over tipping because like you're so frightened that you're going to get it wrong. It's like you don't want to be that guy that someone's looking across going, yeah, that guy's just stiff me for, you're like, oh, just, you're just throwing money everywhere. You're literally just throwing money. It's just, I'd rather do that than walk away with a bad rep. So
we need to have y'all back for a don't be that guy Mudball Monday. But that's a great
done that.
That's a great shout out. Guys, what was the I guess what started the conversation with like, hey, let's go over to the US and do a trip, and you know, how did that evolve over time until you had something on the books? And then if you just don't mind running us through what the trip actually looked like as far as the courses you played.
Yeah, so we were asked by Colin Sheehan to play, and it's essentially the New Year's Foursomes, which is a bit of an outpost club event. And we'd met Colin about the summer of last year, did a podcast with him, I think about the same time he finished at Yale. And, you know, he said at the time, he's like, I'd love to get you guys over to a hoopie and sometime in January. It's great. Everything goes dormant, plays quick. I thought, yeah, brilliant. It's the sort of thing that's like, wonderful offer. Very nice of you to think of us. Don't ever expect to hear back, but would absolutely love to go. And then got the email through from Colin and Will Smith. And we're like, yes, like we should 100% do this. Like there's, you know, this is perfect. And we'll build a bit of a trip around it. And then another friend of ours, the guy Ryan from the Addington. And I think you've played the Addington before, Henry, haven't you?
Yeah, he had me around this past summer at the Addington. Very, very fun to... Yeah, really cool to see, you know, the course and his vision and have him walk me through every little piece of it. Yeah, really, really cool deal that he's got going there.
Yeah, so then we came out as a three and we stopped off in Aiken on the way down. I hadn't actually, if I'm honest, heard huge amounts about Old Barnwell until such time as we'd organized the trip. And then I was like, wow, like you guys were doing some content about it, starting to see loads of stuff sort of popping up as they open for preview play. And very, very luckily, Brian Schneider teed up for us to visit there. That was just a treat. Went down to a hoopie. And then on the way back, we played Tree Farm. I should add, we also stopped off in Atlanta for a game at Peachtree, which we were, very, very lucky to see that as well. Which is the second time I've visited Peachtree, actually, and now I'm talking about it on the podcast, I fear it might be my last.
You won't be going back.
But I mean, yeah, that, if I'm honest, the first time I'd hit a golf ball in the States was 5 years ago on a trip out to, remember when we did our thing last year playing at Palmetto in this sort of Knowles Goodyear Bowl that we've played in as a club for a number of years, and Peachtree was the first place on that list. So first time I'd ever hit a golf ball was at Peachtree. And if I'm honest, it's so I guess there's so much to take in. You're not really processing just quite how good that golf course is. And then going back and seeing it, it was like, wow, I just forgot how spectacular that set of greens are. Absolutely extraordinary. And people like, you know, Robert Trent Jones get a bad rap and stuff, don't they? But his work there with Bobby Jones is just absolutely sensational.
We also, when we, because it was the first place we played, and there was quite a significant frost delay in the morning. So we got out, I'd say, from memory, was it 1 o'clock, Sam, or 12 o'clock, something like that?
Yeah,
we got out
that midday.
By the time the frost had cleared. And, that was another thing about your climate is just crazy. It goes from being really cold to like mild and nice, and then drops down to really cold. It's just something you just don't get in the UK. It's consistently miserable in the UK. but there was a frost delay, and we went out, and they kind of came and not apologized, but you know the greens are not quite as quick as we'd like them. We couldn't cut them because of the frost, and I mean, they were rapid. I mean, and some of the caddies, I've never seen a ball stop on that slope before. And, you know, it just, that was our kind of introduction into greens on this trip. They were really quick, but it just turns out America, just, you guys get them really quick everywhere. I mean, Ohoopi was silly, 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 silly fast. Just so fast. I can't recall playing on anything like it. But yeah, that was our introduction to the trip. So
So before we dive a little bit more into Ahoopee, Barnwell, Tree Farm, curious to hear, like, Sam, you mentioned that first time you came over, played at Peachtree, and you were kind of just like trying to get your wits about you of things being different in the States, golf wise versus the UK, obviously. We, Walker and I, being Americans, understand what people from America think of going to play in the UK. I'm curious what people talk about in the UK going the other way, coming to play in America. Like, what is kind of the lore around some of the top American courses? Is it a common thing for people to come over and try to get on the different private clubs? And then what is kind of the reputation that comes with that at some of these different courses?
I think you know, look, the big thing here is like the private thing, right? So, you know, the access is there's a wall up, right? With a lot of golf clubs in the US. Now, from a reputational standpoint, as you know, scarcity drives demand. So people, you know, people over here, you know, there's, you know, these clubs are revered. So it's so, I guess, you know, there's a huge demand to play, but people don't just take a punt. People don't just book a flight and go out to New York and go, hey, I'm just going to wing it. I'm just going to get myself onto National, or I'm going to go and play Garden City or whatever. You know, that these guys are, you know, I guess invariably people go over in trips. I think I'm not seeing loads of people from the UK go out to some of the big resort places. You know, one that jumps out to me has been looking like it's extremely customer friendly would be something like Streamsong. I haven't seen loads of people in the UK going out and doing trips over there. You know, people who want to get a bit of sun on their back will go into continental Europe. The quality of the golf can sort of nosedive at that point. You kind of get holiday golf. It's just not quite the same. But I think, you know, look, by and large, you know, people go to America and they just absolutely love it. People go, they'll do it in a week sitting. Invariably, they'll do what we've done and they'll bite off an amazing list of courses. You know, they'll probably have something to anchor their trip around. And I think, you know, my understanding is that, you know, access becomes a little bit easier when you're kind of booked and you're going. Your host at Club A might help with Club B or C, or know a friend at Club D, and it all works that way. What do people say? I guess probably not dissimilar to what we think. You know, courses are exceptionally well looked after. The whole scene, at the way, you know, everything is so luxurious. You know, you don't have to think about anything. It's all done for you. Greens are exceptionally quick. Like, just you're playing a different sport on those greens than the club golfer in Britain. Like, I cannot stress the difference in the green speeds. And hell yeah, like cost, that's a step up as well. You know, people will buy through cash, but you guys do it so well. Like it's
Spending.
done so good. Yeah, it's very spendy, but it you know, I just think you guys do it well. You know,
Don't do golf
that's
well. I
the
thought you
one
said
thing
do
I'd say.
spending well.
Well, they do
Well, I'd
spending
push
well as
back.
well.
I'd push back a little bit about your comment regarding resort golf, because I think visibility is kind of a big thing over here. And when you think about, you know, when we mentioned just then that we were lucky enough to play Peachtree, you both did a big nod. It was like, oh, that's really cool. Whereas I think if you told 95% of the British golf population to play Peachtree, they'd have no idea where it is or what it is. And it's kind of, I'd say there's a big drive towards things that are on television. You know, if you went out and played Hilton Head or wherever, you know, that's got a kind of reputation. Outside of that, I think it's just a little less visible, and they don't really, you know, they're not, if it's not in the top sort of 30 in the world, they're not kind of, oh yeah, I know where that is. It's so I think if you're lucky enough to kind of be in the circles where you know about the place, these places, and can be cheeky enough to ask, then yeah, it's really kind of the lore around it is a big thing. But for your average UK golfer, I'd say, you know, outside of world top 50, even if they are like spectacular, like Tree Farm or Barnwell. I've told a few people that we play all Barnwell. Tree Farm's a bit different because it's got this Zach Blair thing around it. It's very visible. Barnwell, no one's even heard of it. No one's got a clue. So, yeah, I mean, visibility is a big thing, I think.
So, getting into the different courses, Peachtree, Old Barnwell, Tree Farm, And a Hoopie, all very different golf courses, being that they're in the same region. You guys played Peachtree first. We picked away at that a little bit. I want to talk about Old Barnwell, from my eyes, being probably the most similar to the golf that you see over there. Obviously, some key differences in conditioning, green speeds, all the rest. But what did you really enjoy as far as something that you just kind of, you know, you're on the flight home thinking, man, that was something that I'm really going to hold on to and remember for a long time, versus things that, you know, was fun to see, but not as interested in. Is it true that Old Barnwell was kind of most similar to home, or did you guys see similarities elsewhere?
I'd say Old Barnwell was probably more different to anything I've ever played before in my life, I guess. You know, I'd say it was an extraordinarily different golf course. I loved it because it was, to me, it felt really innovative. I think Tom nailed it on about the 10th we're walking down. He said, this is the closest I've ever seen like a new build golf course come to replicating the principle of the old course, because with what we're playing with now, it is so hard to actually make a course like the old course play the way it does. And it does so because it's got exceptionally firm land and it's got a stiff breeze that plays through it quite often. And that really helps. And if you're trying to build, if you just lift and shift the old course and put it into Bermuda, you just eliminate the strategy. That's the fact of the matter. So, you know, the extreme nature of the slopes, the exceptional width within the playing corridors, but then the very, very small targets that you have to play to score well. I thought, like, wow, this is so innovative. And I loved the shaping. I thought the shaping was so different. You've got, you know, none of it really exists that much over in the UK, but you used to have, way back in the early 1900s, you'd have this old Victorian steeplechase bunkering, and you can see there's even some sort of, there's like some replication of that. I loved Old Barnwell. I thought it was, I wouldn't say it felt really similar to British golf. Tom, I don't know, you might have a different take. It felt very different and very, very innovative, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose for me, Barnwell, this is really hard to say, because the experience was exceptional everywhere. But the experience of getting to Barnwell, and it's kind of, the road's not built yet, so you're on, like, you're driving through sand and it's bumpy up and down, and you think you're lost, and you turn up to this shed, a mobile home, that's kind of the clubhouse. And you go into the shed, and all of a sudden, it's like there's five people there, and they're facing you, and they're so friendly and so welcoming. And you've got this little, tiny little pro shop, and they're giving you Chick-fil-A. They've gone out and got this in the morning, and it was just so lovely. That, I mean, our third wheel, Ryan, who forgot something back at the hotel, so needed to go back to the hotel, and we ended up sitting in that cabin for like an hour, just sort of chilling out and drinking coffee. And you walk around that shed, and this landscape opens up from a forest that you've got no right to see as far as you can see. It's kind of, it's almost alien-esque, in terms of you just suddenly looking out across a huge landscape that's undulating in a really macro level. It's got a huge rise, a fall, and a rise, like a big half pipe. And then on a micro level, the contours within it are so interesting and so absurd, really. I mean, I really appreciated the boldness of the shaping and the finishing, because I think once you throw out, if you throw out the notion that you want everything to look natural, if you just embrace that you can have artificial shaping, you can then start to put really interesting features around the greens, and it doesn't look like it's been there, like that was the shape of the land. But what it does do is it really makes the shot interesting. So, I mean, pin high left on one, it's a par five, you know, pin high left on one. If you're off the green,
you're screwed.
I mean, it's absolutely
very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just because they were bold enough to put in old course-esque humps in between you and the green. And if that was a bunker, you know, you've seen it 1,000 times. You know, we've all played over bunkers or been in a bunker and played to a green, but trying to navigate around a huge swale is it's a lot more interesting.
Yeah, I think you look at courses like Instagram generation, right? We look at golf courses now a lot on our phones, and you know, it. You look at a lot of new courses being built, and you think, "Wow, that looks wide open. Oh, that looks really wide open." And I suppose there's a danger that it becomes width for width's sake, and it's just wide open because we want it to be playable. And I think that's a fair argument. But when it's wide open to the point where you can just take a run at the tee shot, and it has very little bearing on what side of the fairway you finish up. Yeah, that's not great design. And you sort of see a few pictures of Barnwell, and you think, God, that is wide open. That's absolutely crazy. And then you just don't appreciate. Just you stand that first tee, and you're like, oh my God, I've got to hit this exactly 265, and I've got to hit it right on the edge of that bunker, otherwise I'm screwed. You're like, that's really clever. That's so hard to pull off. And it does it over and over and over again.
That was one of my big takeaways as well when I played there, is I had heard from a lot of people, yeah, it's open, hit it anywhere. But I think that completely overlooks the strategy of it. Like, sure, like short grass is short grass. And if you're going to say, hey, I'm just trying to find the short grass, you can hit it anywhere. But that doesn't tell even a bit of the story, right? Like you want to be in the right spot for the visibility, for being able to manage the different features. So I completely agree with you that the whole idea that it's just like completely wide open and you can do whatever. If you want to shoot 77, sure, but you're not going to score well from the wrong side. A lot of those
I'd
fairways.
Love 77.
Sorry, I should have shaded a bit higher there. As soon as I said that, I was like, damn it, that was way too low. But that's fine.
I'll tell you one thing I wasn't prepared for was the Dormant Bermuda. Across mm-hmm. It was across all four courses.
Okay, so what did you think of it? I'm curious to hear from your perspective.
Loved it.
Good. Yes, I love the Dormant Bermuda. Yeah,
as long as there's sand underneath.
They paint the greens green, right? They dye. Yeah, that's dye to get the. But you need it for the contrast. You know,
you need it for the contrast. Yeah,
right.
I'm gonna push back on that because we don't struggle when everything's green. You know, like if it's got fairway and a green, it's all green. We're not thinking, oh God, where's the green gone? I think you could not dye it. I don't know. I've never seen it, but wasn't prepared for it. It played brilliantly and was just thoroughly beautiful. Just strikingly beautiful.
I've told that to a lot of friends who are from different parts of the States and haven't necessarily seen kind of the southeastern Dormant Bermuda, that it's a weird sell to be like, no, golf is actually like, it might be better in the winter when it gets a little cold. And yeah, you get some days where it's going to be colder than you would like, and you get some frost delays. But yeah, that part of the country, especially the Aiken area, when you get a nice, you know, well, shoot, can I put it in Celsius? You get a 12, 15 degree day. And I have that nice Dormant Bermuda, greens are moving. It's really good conditions for golf. Mm.
And it was firm. They weren't sticky. Like they get those things to really release. Like you can't, you know, pretty much all of the greens, you know, they really do chase away from you. I think what's very hard to replicate is what we get around the aprons and out off the putting surfaces to get that chase. You know, if you go and play at the Ancient Links, or dare I say some of the, you know, a lot of the Heathland courses and stuff in the UK, the ball naturally chases away. Whereas I think Bermuda, you know, fairways and stuff, it still sticks a little in the ground. It's always hard to replicate that. But I think the Dormant stuff just feels a little quicker. It feels a little faster and shiny. And it still chases away from you that a little bit more. So, you know, if I had friends saying, you know, golf trip to Carolinas in January, I'd be like, yeah, jump at it. Like, it's a really nice time of the year to play. I loved it. Club culture as well. Like, you know, I'm a sucker for this stuff. But I really, really like the, you know, the vibe there. You know, Kitty and the guys in the shop, and you know, I think the ethos, what those guys are trying to build, it's a really family friendly club. Like they're trying to break the sort of stereotype of it's just being an individual sort of high rollers private members club. This is about bringing families together. They've done a Lido inspired competition for the kids course, so they've got the kids to design some cool features on this little par three or short course. You know, no adults allowed unless they're accompanied by kids, all that kind of philosophy. It's like, yeah, this is really cool. So, and I think that really adds to it. Like the fact that gone out, you got Chick-fil-A afterwards and beers in a koozie or whatever afterwards. It just, yeah, it was, you know, it's a special place. And go on, Tom.
Well, I just would add as well, circling back to the caddies thing, the caddies at Barnwell with the Evans Scholarship kids, and it was all like, it was just really cool. It was, you know, it was just very, very cool place to spend time, and somewhere I would have, you know, liked to have spent a bit more time. And I'm really interested to see how they develop over the next few years with the additional stuff they've got going on there, because that place could just explode.
I'm torn on this.
Do you see
sometimes.
A lot of Evans? Do you see a lot of the Evans stuff in the rest of the states? Is it pretty well taken on?
So it's out of Chicago, is where that started. I got it. I'm assuming Evans is a specific person. I don't know the exact exactly where it came from, but yeah. So in the Chicago-based clubs, you see a ton of it. But then outside of that, I think it's like a little bit picky choosy. Like people will latch onto it and say, "Hey, we would love to do this." But you wouldn't see it necessarily everywhere. But it's a great program. The number of kids that they've put through college and all that is really fantastic.
The difference too cool. between having like a killer caddy, like somebody who does this for a living and it does it really, really well, and having somebody who's still just like getting their boots wet a little bit, is it's a fun dynamic. Like you get to walk and talk by hole three or four, kind of learn more about where they are in their process and their journey. And like, there's something about a casual round warranting that versus like obviously a competitive round. You want somebody who really is dialed in on all fronts. But I loved it. I wasn't really expecting to take caddies when we played Barnwell and just had like such a wonderful day out there. Want to transition?
I would add with that, just quickly. I would add, there is nothing more character building than being a 17-year-old and carrying my bag when I can't hit it around a golf course and still trying to be polite. You know, I mean, how character building. She just kind of had to be like, "Oh, that's good. That's fine." You know, still try and make conversation, still be nice. I mean, everything you need in a human being is developed in that golf course, trying to get me around a golf course.
Yeah. Imagine watching me chip like, you want me to stay here or do you want me to I'll bring your putter out to the green when you're done? You know?
Great segue though, Walker, on caddies. I think it was with Henry. Was it your caddy from the USAM, Cherry Hills?
Mm.
I played with him at Blackwell in. He's now playing in the.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's doing a year in year at Oxford. So we played against them in a university match. Played with him at Blackwell. Great guy.
Yeah, yeah. Very cool. He was sharp. He studying math at Oxford, and he was like way better at math than I was. And amazing with so you go from here sea level where I live in Austin to being in Colorado, like a lot of calculation that goes into that, and some of it is pure math and some of it is also just intuition. Like the ground is a little firmer and like you kind of need to build in an extra few percent of just like, I don't know, it's just juicy out there, you know. It's not just like hey, it's exactly 10%. Sometimes you're just like, it's a little firmer, the interaction with the turf. And I mean, this guy was like to the half club was like nailing my numbers within like six holes. It was really impressive. I mean, I hit my 9 iron, you know, 160 yards. And it felt like by the fifth or sixth hole, he was like, okay, 192 X, Y, Z, you know, net this, net that, light 9 iron. Is that what you're thinking? And I'm like, that's exactly what I was saying. Like really, really impressive stuff.
I've got to play at altitude. I cannot wait to do that.
Yeah, yeah, it's fun. It's different. I guess you guys don't have a lot of that in the UK.
No, not so. We get golf courses on top of mountains, but we're talking, you know, hundreds of feet of elevation, not thousands of feet of elevation. So
right.
No, we don't have much at all.
And now a quick word about our friends at Good Walk Coffee. Mr. Simus, what's your coffee game been like recently?
Man, I always, and I mean always, have the Mudball Half Calf on me. I've been loving the bump and run cold brews on the go, and lately, it's been the breakfast ball.
Give me a little bit more color on the bump and run cold brew.
Well, I love making coffee at home, but I can't do it all the time. And when I really got to move and I need my good walk, I reach straight in the fridge, grab a can, and go, and I get exactly what I need.
Where can the people go if they want to get involved with our friends at Good Walk Coffee?
You can purchase all your coffee, cold brew, espresso, pods, cases, beans, merch, and more for 20% off using code THETIE, that is THETIE, at checkout. Set your custom subscription. The world is yours only at goodwalkcoffee.com.
Walker, where are we headed next?
I wanted to talk about Old Barnwell because we were talking about how big the crazy the features are out there. And Tree Farm is a little bit more subtle in a way. One of the things that I was looking at Barnwell is like, yeah, it's big. Yeah, it's bold. At times, yeah, it's insane. That's obviously what makes it great. But when you zoom out, like especially looking at aerials as they've come out, like the course has just gotten more and more photographs taken of it. There are just drops of features. Like there are not as many features as it looks like from the ground. Like, yeah, there are holes like 14 just has like a lot of bunkers on it. But by and large, there aren't that many features out at Old Barnwell. They're just massive in scale and they really play into the width and the design. I found that super interesting. One of the things that Henry and I have been talking a lot about is just how few bunkers they've used at the Tree Farm. And would love to hear you guys compare and contrast Old Barnwell and Tree Farm just as far as like subtlety and design and how that actually plays out in your rounds. Anything there?
Yeah, who's going, Sam? Are you going to tackle this one?
Yeah, I guess the weird thing is if these courses weren't, you know, what, 45-minute drive from each other and they hadn't opened within the same season, I think they're really hard to compare would be my honest take. I think they feel very different. You know, I think I said the great thing about Old Barnwell is that it feels innovative and it feels like it's not just a wide open golf course that's a new build where it's all about playability. It's actually pulled off with a high level of intellect. And I would say in a completely different way, I was really shocked at quite how restrained Tree Farm was. And I don't know why that was. I suppose knowing that it's, you know, Zach Blair and he's been working on this project for ages. And, you know, I know there were some changes around with the routing. And, you know, I guess I just, it had not been unfair to Zach, but just sort of thinking, hell, this is his first golf course. You know, it feels like you'd want to make a big statement. It would be really hard not to go all out, like just turn the volume up to 11 and just go for it. And I was really surprised at quite how classical that design is. It felt very similar to a St. George's Hill in the UK. I think a lot of people say the profile of the land is similar to Pine Valley. You know, those lucky people will know better than I will. But I was just really surprised at how different it actually felt to Old Barnwell. They both seem to have very, very minimal use of hazards, which I think is really cool. I think, you know, it's good that we're coming away from just throwing in a litany of bunkers at every hole and just kind of constantly over hazarding things and trying to sort of pump everything up. It was really restrained, but in a different way. So, you know, we did a podcast with Brian and Blake talking about the development at Old Barnwell, and they were sort of saying how they used the bunkering sparingly, but when they used it, they went big because it matches the land. And I think that's probably a big point of similarity with Tree Farm is, yeah, they don't need to go all out on bunkering. They've got a staggering rolling piece of land. But again, it felt really classical Tree Farm, you know, like it just feels like a timeless golf course, you know, and I mean that in a really nice way. It's not, that doesn't mean it's underwhelming, you know, by comparison, it's still a very provocative golf course, but it just felt a little bit more sort of pared back and just, you know, I guess sort of, yeah, a little bit more familiar to what we would see in the UK.
So adding on top of that, Tom, I guess anything there at Tree Farm that you just kind of popped out versus Barnwell?
I echo a lot of Sam's sentiments, really. I mean, I think the similarities are driven by location and timing. They're very, very different, really. I mean, Tree Farm, I mean, that section where you progress from the 12th to the 13th and then all the way in is just staggering, staggering set of holes over there. That's nothing to take away from the first 12, but 13 and in is just a staggering set of golf holes. You know, then it's interesting that, you know, that Zach and came across and did his trip to the UK and looked at a lot of places, and you can kind of see the nods to a lot of things in a lot of places, which was, I think it's the fifth hole, it's a drivable par four, I suppose, for good players. that's got the kind of the nod to rye. We call them the rye brows. But he apparently got in there with a shovel and did it with some bricks. And, you know, you've got the fourth, which is nod to Pine Valley. And then you've got the Redan Hole, which is, for what it's worth, Sam and I, we've talked about this off air, I think is the closest. I mean, I know you guys do template holes far more than we do in the UK. It's just not a thing in the UK, to be honest. But that is the closest thing I've ever seen to actually playing like the North Berwick Redan. Is that 15th? Is it at Tree Farm?
It's high praise. Yeah, it is 15.
The only slight difference you would get, I mean, it plays pretty much identically from the moment you're on the green. The only tiny difference is North Berwick, you play uphill slightly, and then it goes over and runs away. And this is slightly down, ever so slightly down. But apart from that, it plays perfectly like it, I'd say.
And we one thing that we both had in common was we were playing down 16, which I think that was the green that Zach got most involved in, that crazy sort of punch bowl, double punch bowl, whatever you're going to call it. But yeah, you can basically putt in the opposite direction to the hole, I think, at any point in time, and it might not be a bad strategy. And we're both sort of sitting there thinking, because you're always thinking about this stuff, you know, when you're going through the round and thinking, yeah, God, the par threes are good here. The par threes are good. They're all sort of all pointed differently, all playing different yardages. Both sort of said, coming off 16, just said, feels like it's just missing a shorty. Just needs a little 120, 130 yard par three to put you, to make you feel uncomfortable. And then you get to 17, 18, it's there. And whether that's just like, I suspect that's just coincidence, but I did really enjoy the way that the golf course built up there. I like the way that, you know, it seemed to increase in profile. Like you say, when you cross that little service road and you go to 13 up a dogleg right, it feels like it's marking the sort of crescendo that you're building up to as you go in. And I loved 18. Like, I really think golf needs more drivable par four set last finishing holes. You know, some of the best golf courses in the world. I mean, yeah, exactly. And it's not just the old course, you know, like Macrahanish, North Berwick, you know, these places have some genuinely exceptional short 18ths, and they really do make for a lot of excitement. So I think the biggest thing in common between the two is the cabin culture and no clubhouse. And it's like, that actually works. I'm sure those guys are both going to put in incredible clubhouses, and they're going to be beautiful, and they're going to cost a lot of money, and it's going to be great. But it does show that you really don't need that. If you develop a really great golf course, I was surprised just quite how good those things are. They're all serviced. You got like great food out of them. And there's an intimacy with them as well. Like the fact that when you've got six people in them, it feels quite cramped. It's kind of nice, you know?
I'm going to flip this a little bit. This is the podcaster in me. I'm going to flip this a little bit to you, Henry and Walker. What's the prevalence of par three starters in America? And where do you stand on a par three to start your round?
It's very rare. You know, you guys mentioned nods to the Heathland, and I think that was certainly one of them at the Tree Farm. If I'm being completely honest, there has to be one somewhere that I've played, but I'm drawing a total blank on other par three starters in the States. Mm-hmm. You know, and I can think of a handful off the top of my head in the UK. So personally, I'm not at all opposed. From an architectural standpoint, I guess I would say I'm not at all opposed. Now, you know, anytime you have like a shotgun, like, you know, Walker and I both played in school, and if you have a shotgun start and you have to start on a par three, especially if it's one of the more difficult ones, you're always kind of like, well, you know, feels like I'm kind of starting a half shot over par, you know, because you're like a little bit nervous, and like having to swing a five iron or something first swing of the day always kind of feels that way. But I think, you know, speaking directly on the Tree Farm potentially, the way that hole is incorporated within just the entire scene, with, you know, ultimately with the clubhouse being right there and people eating breakfast and lunch, and then obviously the 18th coming as well. I think the execution of that as a par three starter was really great. But anyway, just to simply answer your question, prevalence is extremely low of par three starters.
And I can add ones either. I can add almost nothing to that. I did play one in college that had an opening par three. It's not even worth talking about. Really poor golf course, but I echo everything Henry said. It's like, it's not super prevalent. Have no problem with it. But it's going to be interesting. It's not that hard of a shot. I mean, you've got that bunker left, and if you've got a left-hand pin and you choose to go after it, you know, you can get yourself in trouble. But even on like a handshake par four or opening par five, it's like, yeah, if you duck hook it, you're probably still going to be in trouble. So I think there's a little bit of that too, where you just have to get up there and hit an all right shot and, you know, put a 50 footer and hopefully make it and go to the second. It's all good. There are plenty of places to make up your strokes.
It's an easy
too
to get yourself away.
Yeah.
Would that easy be seen in the US as being quite a bold decision to start with a three, or?
I would say so. Yeah.
Probably. Yeah. I want to volley that one back to you guys and ask how you reacted to it, seeing as, I mean, I can think just, you know, you mentioned the Addington with Ryan Nodes and they have a par three opener. Royal Lytham in St. Anne's par three opener, pretty straightforward one. I mean, there are a lot of them. How did you guys react to that?
Berkshire Blue starts off with a monster par three. It's like 210 yards. Pretty. It's like, it's crescent moon shaped, kind of arcs around sort of around your left. And it's all
like a
downhole,
isn't it? Really? It's like a sort of
all heather
way around.
So it's like, if you've just got to smoke a decent shot to start the day off, and it's, yeah, intimidating. But you do get it in the UK a little bit, not tons.
I don't necessarily dig it, but if it's there, it's like, that's the course, you know, like it's,
yeah,
you know, put it this way. I'm not going to put the clubs back in the car and head out. So
that's exactly right.
Yeah. You know, I think Southport and Ainsdale is another course on the northwest coast. Two out of six, really, there. Some six or seven really good courses on the northwest coast, and two of them start with a par three. But it's rare. It is. There's something weird about, like you say, holding a long iron and having to hit, like, hit the green. It's just, it's not a great feeling. But yeah, no.
Especially when two of us are big hosel guys, real big. We like a good hosel every now and then.
I'm not afraid of a hosel every now and then. It's just part of the diet. I want to change gears here a little bit. You know, you're over in the States. You mentioned how, you know, you kind of plan one of these golf trips, and once you arrive at location number one, talk to a few people, and it's at least easier than it was from the UK figuring out logistics or how to play the next golf course that you want to play. By the time you guys left, did you have an idea of like, oh, there's some other, we largely took care of this, you know, South Carolina, Southeastern USA region. We want to do this region next. Has that been on your mind? Was there any talk during the trip of like what else you guys need to see in the US?
We left a bit out there. Like we had a really bad storm on the Tuesday, and we'd popped into Palmetto. We know Brooks there, and we sort of said, look, hey, pop by if we can play Palmetto on the Tuesday. I really want to go to Aiken Golf Club. I think it's great to compare things as well in like the same sort of space of time. And I'd just love to have taken Tom to Aiken Golf Club and just how good that is, because, you know, it just shows you just how, you know, great golf can be in a completely different way, I guess. I don't know. I think that's just a heap of America to explore.
There's so much.
Like, in it, I guess it feels almost overfacing.
Yeah, I would say, kind of, to answer your question, that I didn't feel like I needed to go somewhere else. I felt like I needed to go back there and finish the job. You know, it
was okay.
Almost like I just had a taste of it, and they felt like, I mean, even didn't Zach talk to us about there's a little nine holer in Aiken?
Yeah, there's like the chalk mine,
the par three course.
And you feel like you're kind of driving around blind and going to these places because you've arranged it, but actually there was so much we didn't do. And I've never seen Palmetto. We went out and stood on the 18th in a thunderstorm, you know, had a look down the first fairway. It looked very, very cool. You know, there's so much there that I'd really like to go back and see some of these places that I've not seen before. I think about, you know, we need to. Plus, you guys set us up with some great ones. You guys,
Camden,
great list.
I was talking to John about Camden. I was like, God, I want to, if we're going back up that way, we could go and play Camden, or, you know, I'm so desperate to go and play Tobacco Road. It's untrue. Like, I really would like to go and see that. People talk a huge amount about Congaree. Like, I couldn't believe how many people talked about Congaree as being just like a knockout day.
We give Fazio so much
great
shit, but Congaree's really good.
Yeah, if we Yeah, we that's well put. Like we give Foz a hard time, but Congaree, like you will love it. And as like a day of golf, if we're gonna put the whole thing together, I mean, yes, knockout day. It's absolutely fantastic. I want to ask you guys one more question that we missed on Tree Farm. One of my favorite things about golf in the UK is the warm-up nets as opposed to the range. I'm such a fan of like 12 four irons, hopefully not on the hosel, and let it rip. In fact, I actually, when I played with Ryan Nose this past summer at Addington, I think I caught 3 hosel balls in like 12 swings warming up, which is just fantastic. Anyway, that aside, what did you guys think of, and there will be a range. In fact, I think people are off it now at Tree Farm. But how did you guys take to the warm-up nets?
To burst your bubble, we had the range.
Shit. What a airball of a question.
The nets were still there and you could use them. The nets were there.
But why but would look, you?
You're speaking to the wrong guys. I mean, if we hit two, three balls before we go out, that's two or three balls too many.
So even the warm-up nets are just
not our home club, Blackwell. We're actually it's a very small club. I've got to get you some Blackwell. You know, 170 members, tiny little place, and we've got these two nets in like a. It's in part of the brick building. You open a door and there's like a partition. There's two nets either side, and I mean, if you're so inclined, you can hit balls in there. I would say 90% of the membership never bother. You know, bit of warm up in the bar, few swings, you know, maybe a putt, but there's absolutely very little warming up. And we've now reconfigured the inside of the clubhouse, and I think the nets are gone. So there's literally no opportunity, pretty much, to hit a full swing before you go and play. And I'm quite comfortable with that, but I get the sense that a lot of people are not comfortable unless they've had half an hour of reps on the range.
That's American people in the States.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you'll see people complain at, you know, like Palmetto, for example. They have the short, you know, what, 200 some yard range, and
it's ample.
I've done some back foot drivers there. Like it can be done, but realistically, you shouldn't hit more than like a 4 iron. And people are like, oh, you expect me to go play without drivers? And I'm like, if you're complaining about this, you have much, much bigger issues. Like, I think that's user error. If hitting drivers on the range is what you think is going to make the difference today.
I think life's too short. Yeah. Life's too short. We've got things to be doing. You know, there's drinks to be consumed. There's Hooters to go visit. It's just life is too
absolutely.
Short.
I need a Chick-fil-A review too. Like I didn't want to skip over that
because you were getting absolutely.
After it, but I need a Chick-fil-A review. Now, you guys probably didn't have much say because they just probably had sandwiches. But
no, we did a drive-through as well. We did the drive-through.
We actually went back to back. So, so Old Barnwell gave us Chick-fil-A, to which we had, and it was lovely, very impressive stuff. They'd obviously gone out and got it. I don't know how it works over there. Whether they. It's a different set of things they can microwave. I don't know. But then Ryan says, right, that's the warm up. We're now driving straight to Chick-fil-A for another one from a Chick-fil-A. So we went back to back. It was with about a half hour break, I'd say.
Do you remember what
you guys
will
know this?
I went bog standard, I think. They're like, is there a, you know, McDonald's has a Big Mac and that's what you get. Is there a Chick-fil-A version of that?
Henry, the number one, chicken sandwich with fries and a drink, more or less. That would probably be that. Yeah.
Is there better things to order?
So people are into the deluxes, and that's what I was going to ask you, Henry, is like, is the deluxe the default? And my guess, you know, would probably be no. I certainly don't order. I don't get into all that.
I'm not about it. Like I like the spicy chicken sandwich. I like the nuggets. There's a place in the world for the grilled sandwich or nuggets. Not as much in my world, but you know, that is what it is. But yeah, the deluxe I'm not about. I think that the simplicity of the regular sandwich and the spicy is kind of what makes it. I'm a huge Nando's guy. We're actually getting a Nando's here in Austin, and I'm like just supremely excited about that. But Nando's to me has significantly more range than Chick-fil-A, which is what I love about Nando's. Like I'll go and sometimes I'll get wings, sometimes I get thighs. There's always either a, I guess you guys call it a pita, not a pita. They're, you know, the chicken burgers, like you got to get multiple things, but that's the beauty of Chick-fil-A is it's like, look, are we going sandwich? I'm always going sandwich and nuggets. And basically the decision is regular sandwich, spicy nuggets or spicy sandwich, regular nuggets. Like there's not a lot going on here.
What's the spice on a Nando's there? What are you going with?
Are you talking about level?
Yeah, the levels. You got what?
I'm south of extra hot, or like extra
Yeah.
hot, but like I'm going pretty high. I medium
Oh, nice.
doesn't do it for me. I'm like, yeah,
You
pr
just
probably,
douse it in that sauce.
yeah, probably hot to extra. I'm a big fan of like maybe getting hot, and then you know, of course, you can get the sauces yourself on the side, and I'm getting a lot of those and just kind of adding it until there's some pain. You need to feel a little bit of pain.
I don't think there's anything more vomit-inducing than when you're stood in a Nando's and someone orders the garlic and herb or whatever it is, you know, the one that's zero spice.
Yeah,
It's
it's just
kind
so
of, why are you
brutal.
here, guy? Like, why are you here?
I was disappointed this past summer. I was in a Nando's and they have the wing roulette. You know, you get 10 wings and you don't know which sauce is on them. I think like eight of them were a medium or below. Like I wanted to grab one of these things and have it be like something that's off menu, like triple extra hot that was just going to make me like run to the toilet
Yeah,
and
drinking
just
yogurt.
and nothing. I mean, it was just kind of down the middle. Still great chicken, but anyway, chicken talk.
That's good
Just
stuff.
on Chick-fil-A. So with Ryan, I mean, he's an encyclopedia of information. You guys all know this anyway, I'm sure. But apparently, it is the most profitable fast food outlet per square foot in the whole of the U.S.
They have a
Wow, really?
license to print money for sure.
They sponsor an NFL stadium. And on the busiest day for them as a host, like
It's closed.
it's closed on a Sunday, and that's be and apparently it's all back to this. It's quite a religious company originally. The franchisee is only allowed to take on like one restaurant. If they give them two, it's exceptional because they want the owner in the restaurant managing it. And this is like these are just sim these are like really sensible business policies, actually, when you think about it. It's like, wow, these guys have got one hell of a business there, right?
If you
Yeah,
ever
so
meet
it's
like a Chick-fil-A owner, like a franchise owner, they are about their business. Like they are at work every day. There's no messing
Yeah.
around and like it trickles down.
One of the things that always blows me away about Chick-fil-A is, you know, you go to fast food and you just have this assumption, not that I'm not going to like be nice to people because that's certainly not the case, but you just kind of have the assumption that it's like going to a gas station and like the person who is, you know, taking your order or something, like they don't care to be there. They're not going to like make eye contact and all of those things. I always forget at Chick-fil-A that someone is going to like, they're going to look you in the eye. They're going to use proper grammar. They're going to ask you
Yeah.
if they can do anything else for you. And I'm
There's a
always like,
dude stood
I'm kind of
there.
taken aback because I'm kind of just like go in with my like gas station sort of vibe. And I'm like, yeah, give me this, give me that. You know, it's all good. It's all good. And then someone's like, they are on it. It's very impressive.
Couple of points to add to American culture, which is a bit weird. Drive-through ATMs.
Good,
Hasn't got
bad.
over here yet. No, brilliant. Hasn't got over here
Okay,
yet.
it
And
sounds great.
the landscape, putting in of a card, you know, long end first. Honestly, that took
Never
us a
seen
while.
that.
That was
Never seen
blew
it.
our mind. Have you not seen
Well,
it?
never
You
seen it.
guys are doing
Well,
way better than us in the UK when it comes to that, because if I'm not mistaken, 90 plus percent of the time it's the tap anyway. There is no
yeah,
insertion or
100%.
swiping or any of that. And so we're getting more tap, and you know, we use the Apple Pay on the phone. But there's not a lot of swiping or insertion in general. And we'll leave that where it is because people might take those two words in the wrong direction. So, Tom, I wanted to ask you a question. I was listening to one of you guys' things recently, about you talked briefly about the trip. It wasn't a full breakdown, but there was some commentary. And I think we have a lot of listeners that'll be interested here. I think you can give people a lot of help with this. I'm very interested to hear more about the back management program. I think that that's something that would resonate with our listener base. You and Ryan both seem to have like a really good track here on how people need to be handling this. We have a lot of late 30s or early 40s sort of guys. So play it on us. Tell us about the back management program and how important this is to a golf trip, whether it's the UK or
Big
the
health tech,
States.
this is huge health tech business. This, yeah, I mean, to start off with the amount of people we met in the US that own health tech companies, and we're thinking of licensing the back management program and making millions because you guys are still whippersnappers, like 20s. Can't even remember my 20s. When you get to your late 30s, which is where I am right now, where Ryan is and where Sam is. You know, the back just was isn't what it used to be. And about 3 weeks before I went to America, would you say it's 3 weeks, Sam? 3, 4 weeks.
About that, yeah.
I had an MRI scan on my neck, and around about my C6, C7 vertebrae, I had a significant disc slip or bulge or hernia, whatever you want to call it, which was impinging upon my spinal cord. So we're talking serious back issues. And I phoned Sam and said, look, I might not be going to America, which frightened him a little bit. But we said, it's okay. We're going to get on the back management program. And the thing is about the back management program, it's very ethereal. It's kind of, you can't really say what it is because it just involves a lot of alcohol. In Ryan's case, it was he could drink spirits, but not beer. Beer was basically the bad thing for him, including a $75 Negroni in Howe's in Atlanta. Shout out to the overpriced Negronis in Atlanta.
That's crazy.
But essentially, it was a mechanism for us to try and survive America. And stretching, drinking, hangovers, and a very special Starbucks order. That's what did it.
What inspired the Starbucks order?
Ryan's wife. So okay. The Starbucks order, I mean, Ryan is unique, and he likes to customize almost everything that you could ever order that shouldn't be customizable. But if you went into a Big Mac, it'd be a Big Mac with an extra gherkin just for the sake of adding something. So, Sam, fill me in on the order because you've been doing it since you've been home.
It's a grande iced latte with two pumps. Hang on. It's a grande iced latte with blonde roast. That's key. You get two pumps of white mocha, sweet vanilla cream foam, and oat milk is an optional. And you will have absolutely no teeth if you drink three of those in consecutive days.
But they were phenomenal.
But you guys worked hard on the back management program. I think for a lot of it, it's about a brotherhood. So, you know, as I wasn't on the program, and actually I got on it on the last day at Tree Farm. My lower back was starting to hurt. I think we're having drinks, and a lot of this is about a community of supporting people, and Tom and Ryan supporting each other through the back management program clearly paid dividends. I think not carrying their bags helped them. That was key. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's quite bespoke stuff, isn't it, Tom? You know, everyone that's been through the back management program is a completely different plan. It's everything's highly bespoke, customizable. Just get in touch.
I'm trying to be vague about it because we are putting it behind the paywall, and you know, you only really get the information on how you get through the back management program once you've given us some money. So
just ring 1-800 back. That's the
what's just for the people. What kind of rate are we looking at?
It's not cheap, but you do get through golf trips without back injuries. So just get in touch. We'll sort you out.
Sounds good. And we skipped the dirt today, but we will hit a really quick D here. You know, you mentioned that it's very customizable. Tom, how are you customizing your back management program?
Well, I wasn't drinking $75 Negronis. That's expensive, right?
Yes. Very expensive. Yes.
Because it was the first day of the trip, and we were so giddy, and we had no idea, you know, what to expect. And this drink order came through for Ryan. We didn't question it. I can't believe we didn't question that.
I mean, unless it was like 48 ounces. That's expensive.
No, it was a small drink. It was.
I mean, even in the States, tourists slapped across our forehead. I think the thing about Brits is you just walk around smiling inanely at people and asking if they're okay whenever you walk past them, and then apologizing for stuff you don't need to apologize. What was the thing Nick and a Hoopy kept saying, the caddy? And after we'd had him for three rounds, and only on the third round.
Like, cheers.
Cheers. He said to us, said, just like,
what does cheers mean?
Cheers means thank you, doesn't it? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, do we say that a lot? He says, you say it probably three times every time we interact over a shot, minimum. So I was just saying, appreciate it. And he was saying, cheers. And it was quite a nice vibe we had going.
Yeah, it's back and forth. Good stuff.
So, no, I think you guys do drinkable beer better than, you know, session beer. I think you do it better than anywhere. You know, this kind of 4% stuff that it almost hydrates you as quickly as it's dehydrating you. It's almost impossible to get drunk on it. So
nice sociable beer. Miller Lite's way better light beer than Bud or Coors or any of that stuff. I think Miller Lite's the king of light beer would be my
Mickey Ultra was a big drink.
Yeah.
That was a big one while we were there.
Nah, Miller's better than Mick Ultra.
Do you know another big thing is tequila is massive over there.
huge.
I'm a tequila guy. Yeah.
Walker.
And everyone's got this big, like a hoopy, which will be a great segue into a hoopy in a minute. But they're all saying it's this big upper. It's the only spirit that's technically like an upper versus a depressant. So everyone was drinking tequila. I was like, God, I can't believe how big this is. Like, you know, if we had any sense about us, the back management program would also start up a tequila franchise off the side of it as well, because that shit's going to blow up in the next 5 years over here.
Well, people talk about all this, you know, gluten-free stuff. Whatever, you know, like Chick-fil-A, I think that's supposed to be highly gluten-free, allegedly. But anyway.
There's so much gluten in Chick-fil-A.
Oh, it's just gluten-laced. It is the king of gluten. Tequila is gluten-free, if I'm not mistaken, which I think that's a big reason why, especially guys that get a little bit older and, you know, want to keep drinking, they're like, oh, I'm drinking tequila, so I'm doing well. Tequila is good for the back management program, no doubt. I would say, you know, you talk about Miller. Miller is like it's a nice lubricant. You know, it keeps things moving nicely. You feel loose, you feel good. Tequila, I think, is more of just like a painkiller. Like you give me a few tequilas and like that back is gone. Now it might crack on you at some point if you whip one a little bit too hard, but especially the liquor, yeah, it just kind of takes that feeling away altogether.
Well, I didn't miss the warm up in the bar comment earlier. That was nice, and there is a little bit of that. But your spine might snap in the wintertime. We were talking about Bermuda, dormant Bermuda. It's cold enough, you don't get enough range balls, and you're not on the back management program. Snap goes the back.
That's going to go. Yeah. Tell you what's big on the back management program is transfusions.
Yes.
They went down well.
That's strong a Pine Valley well. Thing.
Is it?
Which has been I believe so, and it's been adopted everywhere. It's a great
drink. Oakmont does the cold transfusion, these like frozen transfusions. I played the 21 US amateur there, and a bunch of the members are just like walking around double fisting these things, and you know, kept asking all these like 20-year-olds playing in the thing. They're like, you know, walking to the first tee, like, you want a cold transfusion? You want this? Want that? And everyone's just like, guys, like, this is not back management program sort of stuff right now.
What's in a transfusion? Because I was just ordering them willy nilly, but I don't quite.
Grape juice is a big thing, isn't it? That's the stuff that gives it color.
It's grape juice, ginger ale, vodka, and a little bit of lime, I think.
Heaps of vodka would be my.
That's correct, if I'm not mistaken.
And Tito's is the vodka of choice, I would say.
Okay.
Nice. Styrofoam cup. Very tasty, whatever it was.
So on the drinking front here, we're in a pretty good spot to segue into our final little segment here and talk about a hoopy. But a hoopy, I guess, I'm sure that plenty of people in the UK know about it. I mean, it's gotten a pretty big reputation at this point. And it is the most like destination different sort of experience, I think, of the courses that you guys have experienced. So tell us a little bit about your experience there. I know it was different because you were there for the foursomes. But what'd you think about kind of like the model there and the way that the club runs and the golf course and just the whole experience?
Go for it, Tom.
I'd say it was incredibly intimidating. To walk into, perhaps because of the environment that we placed ourselves in. It's a model that doesn't exist in the UK. So, you know, we turned up, the car was valeted again, which doesn't exist in the UK. That was taken away. We're left at the reception, you check in, you kind of go to your room and dump your bags off. And then you sit in a room with a bunch of guys you don't know, on big long tables, and they kind of sit down and they kind of choose what you're eating. And there's like soup here, right? Sandwich coming out next, and everything's coming out at you. And the food was majestic, really was. But I'd say the first impressions would be fairly intimidating stuff. Don't you think, Sam?
I think that's probably just more like, oh crikey, you walked into a room of like, you know, really well traveled guys from the States. And they're all kind of close friends and they're all super welcoming. So I think by the time the soup had been dispatched, you're sort of straight into conversation with everyone. But I think in some ways that's nice, as you hear so much about somewhere, there's a bit of trepidation going through the gates and just sort of, you know, sussing it all out. And you know that, you know, that's always the mark of going somewhere that's really special. I mean, Tom said it doesn't really exist. I think,
the 11-2 thing, but.
Say again.
Yeah, more like the 11 till 2 model, that sort of.
So that sort of model of like, you know, I think you know, you guys are very comfortable in the private space with this usage-based model and having different tranches of membership. Like that is just, I mean, that I can't tell you how alien that is as a concept over in the UK. Like they would think you've stiffed them if you had different tranches of members, or the idea that you would pay a significant amount to join somewhere and then have to pay usage-based stuff just to play the golf course. But I think the thing with the Hoopy is actually reflecting on it. It is what you would do if you took Rye and then thought, I'm going to put a really modern spin on this and just turn everything up by like, to the power of five. It's kind of what you get. And I think the great British clubs that we love, like the really storied old clubs like Rye or Muirfield or Prestwick, they have this rota or almost timetable that exists. It either exists officially or it's sort of like, generally there. But this concept of everyone comes together for lunch at a set time, everyone sort of eats at a roughly the same time, they all go out and play match play golf, they all stop at the turn for a drink, and those things are emulated, but they're done in a modern way without it feeling like it's, you know, chintzy or contrived in any way, shape or form. So the whole thing, you end up with this sort of, it's a highly curated experience, but it does feel just like a very modern take on, you know, really what like a British match club is, really, which I think is kind of the genesis for it, right?
Do you guys have a lot of match play in the US? Is it a big thing? Like in Britain, I'd say match play is most of what we play, 80% of what we play.
So we're the much same less except over here. The opposite. Yeah. So we play 80% stroke play, if not more.
If not more. Yeah.
Okay. Because it feels very natural for us to be there. Yeah. It's like we go there and it's kind of like, I think that the beauty of match play is the pressure is just completely off, because you can play a hole horrendously and you're like, okay, let's just get to the next hole and hopefully I'll play better or whatever. And you can get into a swing with the match play partners where it's just really, you know, friendly. You get a lot of banter with giving putts. I mean, it was so interesting because we had three flights. That's the sort of thing that we're not used to, is that the way that the flights were done. But we had kind of three flights and we had, you know, some guys from the South America, when they played against some kind of guys from New York area, and just seeing how different, you know, these people are, and like, it's huge. It's so different. And, you know, that you can get quite needly with the guys from New York and just, you know, really kind of not give putts and get in their ear. And the guys in the South, they've got their arms around you and they kind of, you know, you feel like they're your best friend straight away. It's just, that was really like a big, big thing for me, over the whole day as well.